I'm Amy Fallon. I'm an Australian-born freelance journalist who has covered and covers human rights. I've covered human rights widely around the world. I've been a journalist for about 20 years, and about 12 of that I've covered human rights extensively. I've reported from, I think, about five continents, Australia, the UK, where I first moved in 2007 and lived for 5 years, and then I went off to Africa for another 5 years, and then I was in Asia for a bit. I've spent time in Canada, and the past few years, I've been in many different places, but I'm back in the UK at the moment.
Can you just tell us, you've had a bit of a grand tour of planet Earth in a way, but one of the most interesting places is Africa. There's lots of changes going on there. It's almost like a tug of war, really, between the old Western colonial powers and the Chinese and the Russians at the moment going on. But can you just tell us a bit about the human rights scene there when you were reporting on it?
I first went to Africa when I was 17, which has really started it off. I went on a youth exchange with the Lions Club in the school holidays, and it sounds a bit cliche, but fell in love with the place and made very good friends, like family in South Africa. So I always knew I would live there, but I actually chose Uganda because it sort of seemed a bit off the beaten track. At the time I went to live there, which was 2012 until about 2016, and I then went back for another year, and I've been back and forth on a couple of trips since.
So what was it about Africa that really, sort of grabbed you?
Yeah, well, Uganda, number one, hands down, it's the people, really. And actually, I'd say that with South Africa too. And I don't want to sound cliche, like white saviour. But Uganda is just, there's nowhere else like it. It's probably the friendliest place on the planet. People are just wonderful. But also, in terms of stories, as a journalist, my God, there is so much to tell. There's so much that is not being told. It's such a fascinating country. It's so beautiful. When I was there, so it was 2012 until 2016, roughly, first time. So Yoweri Museveni is the president, a dictator. He's been in power for about 40 years, and his grip is only, tightening on the country. So there were some really fascinating stories when I was there that I covered. Mostly recently it has been LGBTQ plus rights, with Uganda passing an anti-gay law about a year ago. They first passed one in 2014, and a court annulled it 6 months later. They enacted one last year about May, and so I've mainly been looking at the fallout from that. But I've covered, lots of different things in Uganda, positive and negative. The influence of religion has been one of them. I've written about humanism. I've done a lot on sexual and reproductive health and rights. I've done a lot on freedom of speech. I've written about travel, and it's just like in spite of things going on, Uganda is a country that is beautiful, beautiful landscape and beautiful people.
Okay, Amy. Then you arrived in the UK to look at what's been going on with Julie and also other sorts of human rights. Can you just give us a picture of what was going on when you came here and what you made of this whole case? Because it's brilliant that Julian's free now, but of course there is a bit of a debrief to do here on the, in a way, documenting these successful efforts to get him out of jail.
Yeah, so, I mean, I came back, it was actually during the pandemic. I think it was during the pandemic, so late, about October 2021. And admittedly, I hadn't followed it. You know, I mean, I first saw Julian speak in South Kensington in London. I can't remember the exact place. It was some institute. But I remember it was like the hottest day of the year and the place was packed out. So that was really during, you know, like the WikiLeaks era, the WikiLeaks generation. And, you know, I was doing shifts on the newspapers. And any time I went in, there would always be one story on the front page. And it was what WikiLeaks had revealed. I remember going to a cafe in Soho in central London and they had a dish called WikiLeaks. So I felt like I really, you know, sort of lived through that era. And then admittedly, I went off to Africa and, you know, focused on different things and, yes, didn't pay much attention to it. You know, not that it was in the news an awful lot, but obviously that's no excuse. It was sort of a weird journey back into following it when I got locked down in a youth hostel in Australia during the pandemic, which is a whole other story on its own. But one of the other people I was locked down with is an Assangist, you know, an Australian Assangist, is the Assangivist, as the activists call themselves. So a regular supporter, and he was going to, you know, the weekly meetings in Sydney or, you know, whatever parts of Sydney. And he, you know, like really sort of got me onto it. I mean, he's an activist for quite a number of things, also for refugees. But he said, look, when you go back to London, please, you know, like follow Julian and get in touch. You know, because we haven't, you know, we're not really hearing from him as much as we should be. And I just thought, oh, yeah, okay, you know, something to do when I'm here. But, you know, it needs our attention. You know, there's obviously an issue behind it, press freedom, that needs our attention too. It's quite important. And at the time there wasn't, you know, enough in the media about it. So, yeah, I can't remember what I did first, but, you know, I got in touch and with the campaign and found out the court dates and went down and I went to the Australian High Commission because I mean, it's so impressive what these campaigners were doing. There were 3 weekly vigils at one point at the Australian High Commission out the front, and then at the Eros statue in Piccadilly Circus, and then some would also go to the Belmarsh prison on a Saturday, and on top of, you know, other various events that were on. So I got in touch with them. I met them. I met Alison Mason, who is an Australian who had been living over here. I don't know exactly what role she played in the campaign, but whether she was the founder, but she was certainly co-founder, but she was certainly a member. So I met her, she introduced me to some others, and then I went to, I can't remember what the case was up to in late 21, but I went to the hearing and I met another woman who is now a friend, Sadia, who's also amazing because not only is she a long-term campaigner, but, you know, she's a woman of colour running a business and looking after her ill father at the same time. So she became a friend and I got to know her from going to the court appearances and the rallies. And, yeah, just started to follow it. I met and interviewed Stella at the time. She was Stella Morris I can't remember when it was in... Is it late 2021 or 2022, but at the Frontline Club, and interviewed her. That was around the time they wanted to get married and they were being blocked from doing it. And then in the end, they were finally allowed to. I went, so yeah, I continued to follow it. I went to, you know, went and stood outside Belmarsh Prison with the other supporters on the day of the wedding, and started going to a lot of the other events. I was away because I went back to Africa for some time in 2022, and then I was in Australia for a bit. So I missed, unfortunately, the wonderful chains. What was it? The human chain around Parliament that Matt came up with. But yeah, I've been to a lot of events in the past 2.5 years. Probably. I mean, it got to the point where it seemed there was at least one event on a week in London for it, whether it be, you know, a talk or a book launch. But yeah, so I started to see the same people. And you know, started to really realize that, oh my God, it's about more than Julian. And yeah, if this happens, you know, it's going to be the worst thing, imaginable for press freedom. So absolutely delighted, of course, as is everyone else, about his release, and just so hopeful, because obviously, you know, there's other things, issues that I've worked on, like across my world, like, you know, I mentioned, gay rights in Uganda. So I just feel like this has given me so much hope that, that, you know, like campaigning and organizing and activism, you know, it does work in the end. I mean, not that I've only been, you know, back following this for 2.5 years. There's some people that I've met who have been, you know, who were at the Ecuadorian embassy when he was in there, who have been following it since then.
Amazing. Amazing, really. And what about, I mean, Julian himself was a target. We had a US senator calling for him to be killed. We know that there was massive amount of intelligence surveillance. The London police had their copper on the fire escape, posted constantly in case Julian was to try to escape out the back of the Ecuadorian embassy. There was a massive amount of security service, police involvement. I wonder, throughout the campaign, were there hints that the campaign itself had been infiltrated? Were there peculiar characters that turned up that people were saying, well, who's this chap? You know what I mean? There must have been, I think, you know, a certain amount of interest in the campaign and a wish to sort of steer it, control it, or even just listen to what the campaigners were planning next.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because it does seem like, in one sense, it was a very loose campaign with lots of different groups around the world. And that's what's really interesting about it. Like, for instance, there's this woman, Misty Winton, on. So she's the co-host of what's called Action for Assange. So it's a post-partisan decentralized activist organization and online show. And her tweet on June the 26th after Julian was released is really interesting. She wrote, quote, "The Assange movement proved that I had long hypothesized to be true is in fact possible. A completely decentralized movement of people across the globe from every corner of the political spectrum coming together to get shit done. No corporate or billionaire backing, no hierarchy, just an absolute belief in what we are fighting for and a willingness to do the work. A ragtag crew of nobodies who refused to back down despite punching way above our weight class. We fended off attempts at infiltration and division and kept our heads down and did the thing. I'm so proud of all of us." That's interesting because, on one sense, you know, I always thought it was a very loose sort of campaign and you just did whatever you want, you know, like which I think is true. You know, you turned up whenever you want, you did whatever you could, you know, as much or as little that you could do. And I think certainly every major city in the developed world seemed to have, you know, an Assange group. And, you know, for instance, I know in Sydney also there were weekly protests. But it's only sort of really recently that I was told that, oh, you know, we actually had weekly calls, and, you know, there was a weekly call that I think it was run out of someone from the UK who lives in Europe, you know, on Zoom or whatever. And it was, you know, it was made up of all the supporters from around the world, apparently. So it was, you know, like maybe a bit more organized in the structural sense, if you know what I mean. But in terms of, you know, other people infiltrating it, yeah, to be honest, I don't really, I mean, I have spoken to some of the campaigners, like Truman, this amazing bloke from the UK who started up this Yellow Ribbons campaign. And the idea was that he went out and bought the yellow ribbons that you always saw tied, you know, around the court buildings, and that people, you know, like wore on the lapel of their jackets and things like that. And it became, you know, it became quite a symbol, you know, and in the background of any court hearing, you'd always see, you know, this yellow of ribbons. But it was interesting to him about the movement that he started, and he said that, yes, you know, he'd been harassed, and he said that, you know, his car had been broken into. He thinks his ex account was hacked. It's an interesting question. Like, you know, like, yeah, were security infiltrating campaigners, and to what extent?
Yeah, it may be that they're actually quite concerned that they don't want to become the story, you know, that the campaign itself is being undermined. I mean, these people are very professional. They keep kind of try to make sure that they don't get into the headlines as well. But what about you as a journalist? Because, I mean, you know the principles. We're supposed to be balanced. We're supposed to be unbiased, although at least that's what the public are supposed to think. But, you know, both you and I are campaigning journalists, really. And so did you find it, you know, almost impossible to be balanced about this case and reporting it?
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting question and a huge question. And, yeah, I mean, I would like to think that, you know, my coverage was always balanced. Yeah, and, you know, I did always seek comment from the Australian government and others on issues. At the same time, though, I mean, this has been, you know, what, the biggest press freedom case in whatever, you know, ever, like maybe since, you know, I don't know, Daniel Ellsberg or, you know, one of those people, but ever. Of course, I'm going to sign a petition for Julian Assange, as did many other journalists, and as I did, because it's about much more than him. It's about all of us. And I see what you're saying. I mean, so yeah, I guess in one sense it tested that, but there, you know, there's no way I wasn't going to you know, like, stand up for him. And if I hadn't been covering it, I would have been outside the court with all the supporters anyway. So I guess it does test that a bit.
I mean, were you disappointed by some of the coverage, or even lack of coverage? There were whole months and months when there was nothing about Julian in any of the London press. I mean, you've got literally billions of pounds worth of printing presses and transmitters sitting around with one of the most important cases in history in like a medieval dungeon, you know, but hardly any reporting for months on end.
Yeah, I mean, it's also hard to answer that question in a yes or a no. I think that people did come on board in the end. The public certainly came on board in the end. I mean, they were running polls in the end towards it, and you know, like how many people support him coming home, and I think it was at least 70%. And Australian politicians from both sides of parliament certainly came on end. There was a historic resolution in Australian parliament early this year. So I don't know if that influenced some of the coverage or not. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to rubbish, you know, all of the mainstream media. I don't think that's fair. I think we've got to avoid saying that and, you know, tarring everyone with the same brush. Certainly there were some stories that were disappointing by, you know, journalists in particular that don't appear to have been corrected, you know, by one particular outlet. But then there were some freelancers, you know, working for the same outlet that did really good editorials. So, I mean, maybe next time there will be more and it will be a bit better and, you know, people will take a different approach to it. And yeah, I don't think, you know, that should be forgotten, but I think now, like, we need to get on to it, get on with it and, you know, celebrate this as a win and just, you know, concentrate on what we want to do.
So can you just give us your take on why it was that the authorities in the US or the UK finally decided to release Julian?
I think, you know, they were losing and I think they knew this would have just been the biggest travesty for press freedom, you know, in history and in an election year. How the hell could they have him show up there and, you know, go on trial for what was it, up to 175 years, just for doing his job? I mean, they would never have been able to come back from that. What would Biden or Trump or whoever, you know, whoever gets in have ever been able to, what would they be able to say about press freedom around the world after that? They would never be able to lecture anyone else ever again, would they? So I think they realised it, and I think they know, like, they would have been shown up because the campaign was so strong. Every single human rights organisation on the planet, you know, it was pointed out by Reporters Without Borders a number of times, was of the view that he should not be extradited to the US. So I just don't think that they ever would have been able to come back from that. And they were starting to lose the case in the court in the UK. So I guess they just thought, yeah, like, I saw someone write on X, the jig is up, and, you know, threw the towel in with it.
Yeah, you've also been, just before Julian was released, and in fact, maybe during it, I'm not sure, up campaigning for the Workers' Party. Why did you covering it at least, working with the former ambassador Craig Murray, haven't you? He was a very big supporter of Julian, and a great blogger who we've been following for many, many years, probably at least a decade now, maybe even longer. But he was one of the only people actually in the court hearings reporting on this and doing a fantastic job, and many other journalists actually having to sort of piggyback it off of his reporting. So what was it like campaigning with him?
Yeah, Craig's brilliant, and it was such a wonderful experience going to Blackburn. I think I was up there at least 2 weeks. But yeah, it was just wonderful. I learned so much. To be honest, I didn't really know him. I had come to know him from the Assange campaign, and I knew that he was held in such high regard by the campaigners, you know, because he'd always turn up to all the events, to every court appearance. And Sadia would say to me, oh, do you want me to introduce you to Craig Murray? And you'd always see, you know, because he's quite tall, this sort of, I don't know how to describe him, towering in human rights, you know, like this tall Scotsman at these, you know, cases and speaking outside the court. And I remember at the wedding, we all went and stood outside the court and Sadia introduced me to him there. I think he was wearing a kilt. But anyway, so I knew him from that. I knew he was held in very high regard. And when he decided to campaign for Blackburn, I had actually gone to a book talk with Stephanie, an investigative journalist from Italy. I think she's written about three books on WikiLeaks, and Stella was at it. And I think Ewan McGaskill, who used to work at The Guardian. And afterwards, I went out for some drinks and Sadia said to me, are you going to go up to Blackburn to campaign for Craig? Because some other people have been up, and I thought, oh, yeah, you know, and I'd already seen the call now, but it hadn't really occurred to me to do it until then. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay, like, it might be interesting, but it's also a way to give back, isn't it? And also, like, a chance to see another part of the UK. But, yeah, it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. Such a great town, amazing people, and, of course, Craig's wonderful. He was running mostly, well, he was running because of Gaza, so what, you know, like a wonderful policy to be running on, and just met the most amazing people during the couple of weeks that I was there.
What about, there was some sort of dispute, wasn't there, with, it was almost like someone running against Craig, and they were accusing Craig of running against them. And the idea was they were going to flip a coin and one of them stand down.
Yeah, and I think what they were trying to do was, because there were, I think, four candidates at least running on a pro-Palestine ticket, the idea was, well, from some, okay, let's see if we can get it down to one to go up against Labour, so, you know, we don't split the vote, which in the end didn't end up happening, unfortunately, because it was suggested, I think it was George Galloway that suggested the flipping of the coin, and Craig said, okay, and then one of the independent candidates wouldn't agree to it. As you can read about on Craig's blog and X and elsewhere. So unfortunately, that didn't happen, but it was certainly an amazing, well-fought campaign. And I mean, I don't know Blackwell too well. I hadn't been there before, but I'd say that it was maybe a campaign like they hadn't seen before, or they hadn't seen for a while, in the sense that, you know, like, what's happening in the Middle East has really changed things. But also Craig had the support of a number of high profile people, and he did talks during the election. He did rallies that were watched by thousands and thousands, around the world. And so it was sort of like, oh wow, all these local people in Blackburn are seeing it, but he had the support of so many other people around the world, you know, like watching the live stream, watching the videos, you know, on YouTube later on. So it was sort of like other people could take part.
It seems it wasn't really just about Blackburn, was it? It was almost like a tug of war for the soul of the British nation, you know, the people around the world watching in.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was absolutely fascinating. I mean, he obviously, because of Julian, he's got supporters in Australia he's got supporters all over the UK, Europe, you know, the US, elsewhere. I mean, I had, because, you know, I was tweeting about it, I had people say to me, oh, what's happening? You know, someone in Australia was asking. So it was a really remarkable campaign in that sense. Of course, he had, you know, the local community on his side as well, but it was a really remarkable, unique campaign in the sense that he not only captured the imagination of people from Blackburn, but people from all around the world.
And there were some other, you know, kind of people that stuck their necks out for Julian, weren't there? People like the Pink Floyd singer-songwriter Roger Waters. You've also got the rapper Loki, who, and both of these people are now become sort of activists in their own right, making, you know, highly political speeches in favour of human rights. Also, you know, Cat Stevens. So can you just say something about these celebrities who've kind of stuck their neck out? I wouldn't call Craig a celebrity. I think he's more of a, you know, an activist really, and a journalist. But what about some of these, you know, celeb musicians that have chimed in to add their weight? And it's, you know, it's quite powerful when somebody that, you know, people have got a poster of them on the wall says, hang on a minute, the government's got it all wrong here.
Yeah, so, I mean, the campaign headquarters in Blackburn were amazing because there was, you know, a photo of Loki, the rapper, and a quote from him saying he supported Craig, and then a quote from Roger Waters. So Roger Waters has been a Palestine supporter for a long time. He's a long time supporter of Julian, and a friend and supporter of Craig. So that, yeah, there was a quote from him. Imran Khan as well. But yeah, in terms of celebrities, maybe Roger Waters is one of the biggest supporters of Julian and of Craig, so co-founder of Pink Floyd. So he came up on the Tuesday before people voted, which was on the Thursday. Arrived in a helicopter from London, fresh from an interview with Piers Morgan, and we took him around. He came to the headquarters. He went to a local flower shop, Bloom, I think it was called Bloomin' Lovely, which had a huge sort of floral Palestinian flag in the window, and he met the owners of that. And then we went to the pub with him, and then he gave a talk later. And yeah, so that was all very exciting. And in terms of, you know, I know that, you know, Roger Waters is quote a controversial unquote figure. But the talk on Palestine, you know, it was so fascinating. And it was brilliant, and I learned a lot from it. He said to us that, you know, like Craig and like many of you, I wake up every morning on the verge of tears. He thinks, what can I do today to be part of this movement to stop the genocide of my brothers and sisters in Gaza? But he said that he hoped the tide may be turning, and that you know, yeah, that things will change. And Roger Waters was also campaigning for a number of, you know, non-Labour, people standing as non-Labour MPs. So also Andrew Feinstein in Holborn, who stood against Keir Starmer. What was amazing was that Craig, during this talk about Palestine, also told the story of how, he initiated the case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And that was super fascinating because he told us how he went to the US and met Sam Husseini at an Assange event in Washington. Sam Husseini is, I think he's a Palestinian, but he's a journalist and activist. But anyway, Sam Husseini said, why is no one activating the genocide convention. And Craig thought about it. And of course he had worked as a diplomat in a UK diplomat in Uzbekistan, before he blew the whistle on terrible human rights abuses there. So he understood how the Genocide Convention works. So he wrote a couple of articles and published them on his blog. And then a group of activists started lobbying around the world to, you know, try and get the convention brought into play. But Julian Assange actually played a part from behind bars. And also Roger, you know, because he's famous, spoke to presidents in South America. And then somehow Julian and Stella got this Scott Craig's articles in front of Andrew Feinstein, who is a former ANC, South African ANC MP. And that's how, and then, you know, it got the attention of the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa. And that's how South Africa ended up taking it to court. So, I mean, yeah, an absolutely amazing story of what can be achieved when people are working together. I mean, I was just absolutely fascinated when I heard that story.
I mean, yeah, it is incredible, isn't it? And of course, the ANC government now being deposed.
I mean, yeah, God, yeah. I mean, just think of it now. Yeah, at the time, just when I heard that, you know, like Julian Assange had been involved and that, you know, people were working together, I just thought, oh my God, yeah. And Craig actually said to us, you know, at the time he wasn't actually able to say anything about Julian's involvement.
Good. Well, it's the ANC that have been gotten rid of, you know. So maybe there's been a bit of interference. Who knows? There's lots of. We've got a whole theme on this week's program about election interference, looking at you know, the disappearing postal votes in Scotland, the ID cards that people don't have but the poor people are supposed to have if they want to vote, voter suppression, leaflets not being delivered by the post office, interference and by the press in not listing candidates, just disappearing them. So a lot of, I mean, that's why I mentioned this business of South Africa and the possibility that, you know, there's a wider agenda in moving the politics there because of the South African, very successful so far, actually, South African actions at the International Court of Justice. But anyway, look, we've got Stella, we've got Julian, we've got the kids now all together. What do you think's next for him?
I think we all of us who have been following this and supporting it, I think we're so happy that he's been released and that they're all back together for him, for Stella, because my God, she's an amazing woman in her own right, and you know, the family, for John, his father, and Gabriel, his brother. So I just hope that they can all have a break and have some peace now. I think Julian Assange will be forgiven if, you know, he just went and disappeared for the rest of his life. So I can't imagine what he's been through. I mean, it is interesting to think, what does that punishment of solitary confinement actually physically and mentally do to you, isn't it? So, yeah, I just hope that, you know, they're having, you know, the most wonderful time in the world together, and, you know, getting to see his two young boys again. So I don't know. It's a hard question. I mean, you know, he's known for being a maverick. You know, maybe he will, you know, go back to WikiLeaks. I saw that Roger Waters was actually asked in an interview. I mean, credit to Reuters actually for running this, because they were actually ones who put it out in an interview with him. I mean, yeah, we do rubbish the mainstream media at times, but I thought this was a really good story. But yeah, he told Reuters that he would help fund WikiLeaks if necessary. He said, you know, he can't fund the whole thing, but he wants to encourage whistleblowers everywhere to go to them. So yeah, I mean, I think it would be brilliant if WikiLeaks, you know, if Julian went back to WikiLeaks, because I think we need it now more than ever. And interestingly, I saw only yesterday Tortoise Media in the UK reported that on Sunday, Transparency Organisation Distributed Denial of Secrets started publishing an archive of data from WikiLeaks. So they're doing it as an act of online preservation, because remember, Julian's plea agreement with the US said that he would delete any unpublished classified material that WikiLeaks has yet to publish.
That's a terrible compromise, isn't it?
Well, I know. I mean, this is it. Yes, it's great for him as a man, as a person, as a human, isn't it? But for art, for journalism, for the profession, for press freedom, it's taken a real hit, hasn't it? But yeah, it's interesting that now there's some interest in WikiLeaks, and that DDoS have started publishing this archive again. And I think it would be good if there's, you know, renewed interest in it. So of course it would be great to see him back there, but I feel like, you know, after what a legal battle of 14 years and 11 years being incarcerated in, you know, some way, shape or form. And, you know, I mean, Stella was telling us recently he hadn't had a full day of sunshine up until recently. I think you're forgiven for, you know, going off and doing whatever the hell you want to.
Yeah, well, the fact that he's out, of course, is the most important thing here. And in a way, of course, the authorities incarcerating him, that's part of what they're doing, is they're saying, right, okay, now let's have a bit of a tug of war. And if you don't give us something such as deletion of material which may have evidence, well, I'm sure it does have evidence of abuses of human rights, war crimes, this sort of thing that we've done, that we won't let him go. So this is the way, I'm afraid. I mean, what it does in a way is it just shows us how utterly despicable, crooked and corrupt our so-called democracy is, Amy. But look, looking at the campaign, you know, you had thousands of people around the world coming together, as you said, in many major cities across the planet in Julian's support. Now, he's free. Do you think everyone will just walk away and get on with their lives, and that this campaign is finished? Because I'm sure that's what the US authorities and the British authorities are hoping.
Yes, I certainly think they're hoping that too. There's been some indication that the campaign now switches into pardon Assange mode. So Stella, I think it was at the press conference in Canberra, she spoke about that. And it's interesting that some online campaigners on social media have changed their hashtag from free Assange to pardon Assange. I don't know, you know, like what they've got organised or planned.
Well, there may be a suggestion if Donald Trump gets in, that may well happen.
Yes, exactly, because Trump has, I think, did Trump say that he would consider it?
Well, as I understand it, I mean, I have been following this fairly closely, but I'm afraid I've not got the detail that you have, is that initially there was an attempt. Trump was saying that if Assange pleaded guilty, he would let him go. And in a way, that's kind of what's happened. Julian at the time was adamant that he wasn't going to plead guilty. This is where we're talking about nearly a decade, probably about eight years ago. And so there is this aspect that, well, maybe a second bite of the cherry, Trump or no Trump, Julian's decided to, you know, maybe to drop his principle there just to get out of prison. So yeah, I'm not 100% sure about that. I can double check it, but I think there was an offer from Trump originally to say, well, let's get this guy out of prison if he pleads guilty. And, Julian wasn't prepared to do it at the time.
Yeah, I'm just remembering it. And yeah, I've just pulled up this story from 4 years ago that, he offered Assange a pardon if he denied Russia linked to Hack. But yeah, it certainly seems that is now where, that there is a campaign now to pardon him. And I'm sure we'll hear more.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, it's great that the groups that have come together around the world, rather than just sort of, going back to their, their relaxed existence, are saying, well, no, this isn't quite finished yet.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it's brilliant. I mean, we should absolutely 100% push for a pardon. I don't know how easy it will be to get because I think, I think the plan is to sort of get, more media on side from what Stella was referring to at the press conference in Canberra to get more media on side so we can push for that, which we definitely should do because, this will affect all of us. But, yeah, in terms of doing other things, I mean, campaigners, these Assange campaigners, it's interesting that some were political before this, but then I've met people who said, oh, I've never been political before, Julian. But now, they've said they'll campaign for Palestine. I mean, some were already going to the marches and doing stuff on that front, but they said, they're going to spend all their time doing that, like Jamie, who I met in Blackburn. Also, Imran Khan, his name was mentioned as one of the other political prisoners that we need to support. And in Australia, we've got another whistleblower in jail, David McBride, so his name has come up. And then we've got this other man, Dan Duggan, who is in solitary confinement in the US, wants him. So he's sorry, I have to actually just look his case up to see what he's wanted for. Yeah, so he's a former US Marine Corps pilot, and the US is seeking his extradition based on charges of arms trafficking and money laundering. So he's got about 7 children and, like a wife, and he's been in solitary confinement for about a year or so. So his name has also been mentioned as someone they're going to support as well. So it just goes to show, activism can make a difference.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Imran Khan. There is, they looks like they may release him, but only after his political party has been banned.
Yeah,
obviously, this whole idea, right, and maybe we can finish with this, Amy, of judicial persecution. You could also call it judicial character assassination, using the courts to destroy people's political futures. It's been going on in Pakistan. It's been going on massively in South America and Brazil and other countries. A lot of people talking about this going on in the United States too, with these prosecutions of Trump, which are one. But I mean, it started with an impeachment, which failed, and then it's like, we're just searching around for some, part of the criminal justice system to bash the person over the head. I mean, it stinks of a kind of mafia style corruption. And it's not just in South America, in Asia. It seems to be sort of almost taking over here. And obviously Julian is a part of that. The stuff he's been releasing is massively damning of many of our political leaders. So there's a sort of, in a way, there's a kind of crisis of democracy going on in the West.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is certainly, isn't there? And it is interesting how everything is interwoven. whistleblowing what Craig did. And well, I think, yeah, Craig was in Uzbekistan first, and then, you know, WikiLeaks was launched, and then, you know, like what happened to both of them, and now Palestine, and yeah, everything is interlinked, isn't it?
Yeah, so do you think journalism can survive all this now Julian's out? Is it going to get a boost? How is it all going in the world of the press? Because we rely on the mass media, obviously social media too, to a lesser extent, but they're the eyes and the ears of the world. It's almost like the nervous system of humanity.
I know, yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, journalism has to survive. It has to survive for our right to know and democracy, and civil society, of course. And I think, you know, look, I don't think we can rubbish all of the mainstream media and tar, you know, every single mainstream media journalist with the same brush. But yeah, there's certain sections that, you know, they haven't been great on. But I mean, how much time are we going to spend doing that? It's also about, you know, us starting up new sites and new publications and looking at doing different things, but then also trying to, you know, well, realizing that, you know, that some of the mainstream media does serve a purpose. They're not perfect, but also, you know, trying to improve it. At the same time, it was interesting to go to the Frontline Club early this year, and is it Tim Dawson who is, I think he's of the International Federation of Journalists. I mean, he pointed out, he was speaking about Julian, he pointed out that the media is not a perfect reflection of society, and yeah, you know, it doesn't show that. It gives us what it thinks we need to hear, like what we need to see. So that's something, you know, like really to keep in mind, and I really took away a lot from that, and just, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm always aware of that I need to go and look, you know, be proactive myself and take an interest in things, and, you know, like go and find things, look things up myself.
Yeah, we need to be proactive, and a lot of the mainstream press tends to be reactive, you know, to press releases, this sort of thing, and it's drifting towards being this kind of almost like a kind of corporate announcement service rather than a probing, inquisitive, you know, for the people style thing, which is really, you know, it's that's the sort of journalism I'm certainly interested in. People like Declassified UK. Mm. I mean, there are plenty of sites out there doing this, but they're really not, you know, they're throttled down by many of the search engines, which is a great pity. So it's always a bit of a struggle and a bit of a battle. But anyway, look, Amy, I wonder if you'd just like to share some of your socials with us, if people are interested in following what you do.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm on X the most. Just at Amy Fallon, AmyFallon. I'm actually not on a lot these days, to be honest, on the socials. I'm on LinkedIn. very cool. And I've just started up a new sub. I've just started a Substack, Amy Fallon. I've called it for the time being, trying to bring the A game. So that's very new, and I'm hoping to get going on that. But yeah, like happy to talk to you, and yeah, happy to chat to anyone else out there.
Well, Amy, wish you the very best of luck. It's not easy, as I know, to survive as a freelancer. That you really, you know, it can be. Yeah, you know, I hope you manage to stay in the UK if you want to, and stay where you want to, because it's not the easiest thing to do, is it, to actually get work? I mean, the London press particularly seems to be a bit cliquey. You know, if you're in, you're in. If you're out, you're out. And you've got to try. You've got to have a really good, you know, story. There is this thing, maybe we should finish on this one, is where as a journalist, you're pitching ideas And then you find suddenly 3 or 4 days later, the same thing that you pitched appears in the paper, but someone else has been given the story. You've been blanked.
I know, that's happened. I know. It's probably the worst thing of freelance. I've had it happen. And to be fair, it's happened when I think it's a coincidence. I mean, and this shows you, you do have to be careful with accusing people of being a freelancer. It's happened when I'm sure it's been a coincidence, which makes me feel good in a way, because it makes you think, oh, you know, like I get the news cycle and I get editors' minds, but it has also happened for fact when the idea has been taken and they've actually told me and they've actually said, we're going to give it to a staff reporter to do. I mean, in one instance, I was asked to do the fixing and they said, the reporter's coming over to do it. Can you sort out the photographer and a taxi driver? And what do you do? I mean, like, yeah, this was a few years ago. You have to suck it up. Well, I mean, you're left, you know, you're left. The choices are that you suck it up and feel or you speak out and burn your bridges and still feel. I don't know, maybe now, I mean, I did suck it up at the time. Maybe if that happened to me now, because I think I've become a bit more, I don't know, maybe not confident, but maybe even a bit more outspoken or a bit more, you know, like maybe I stand my ground a bit more. If that happened to me again now, maybe I would actually, you know, have stood up to them and said no way. But, yeah, there's nothing, I mean, yeah, it's not going to end either way, is it? So...
Is it, well, all I'm saying, I suppose, is it's a very, it's almost like being in a shark's pool. It's a very difficult world to survive in. It can erode your confidence in your trust in editors. The only thing to do, I suppose, is if, you know, in any way you have, done any work, like, for example, fixing a taxi, this sort of thing, you know, that's all invoiceable. And, you know, you might actually get a good relationship with a place for being able to do little jobs like that. You know, it's not journalism. It's more research, that sort of thing.
I mean, that's the other way of looking at it. And yes, maybe I should have handled that differently in hindsight. Maybe I should have just said, you know, I'll do the fixing for you and build them. I don't think, well, they weren't offering any money to do that. But yeah, you've just got to
get. They never do.
Yeah, no. But anyway, yeah, so it's very cutthroat. What are you going to do? You've got to get on with it. There are some brilliant publications and great editors out there, and it's just making it work, like getting, you know, new income streams, revenue streams, and doing other work.
Tony Blair's press guys, Jonathan Powell, on live TV once, and it was edited out of the edition on the next night. He was asked about, the cut and thrust, the cutthroat politics. And he said, yeah, well, it's nothing compared to the cut and thrust in the press. And I think there's a certain truth to that. Anyway, all the best with all you do, Amy. And thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tony.